We're back, and I'm delighted to say we're joined, as always, by one of our great contributors to this program. His name is Robert Spencer. He is a world-class public intellectual, I think it's fair to say, but specialist in Islam, jihadism, Sharia, and the various challenges to Western civilization that emanate from those sources. He runs a fabulous online resource called jihadwatch.org. It is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. And he is the author of more books than you literally can shake a stick at, including most recently, The Sumpter Gambit, which talks about how the left is trying to foment a civil war today. Robert Spencer, it is great to have you with us, as always. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you. Always good to talk to you, Frank.
I wanted to start, Robert, as a man who monitors closely the various strains within Islam and the danger that they represent, particularly when the various factions, most notably the Shia and the Sunni, combine in ways that might make them patch over their differences, which are real, to make common action against a shared foe, namely non-Muslims. Do you think that might have something to do with what's going on at the moment between the Iranians and the Saudis under the, you know, ministry of the Chinese government?
Frank, it seems as if the immediate cause of the Saudi-Iran agreement was for the Saudis to be able to relieve some of the pressure that they feel because of the ongoing attacks from the Shiite Houthis in Yemen that are given weapons and funding by the Iranians. They are tired of this constant bleeding sore and constant threat. They see that Joe Biden's America is not a reliable ally, and so they were willing to respond to the Chinese overtures and come to an agreement with Iran that they hope will secure that front in Yemen for them. At the same time, there is a great negative potential in this alliance because there's an old Arabic adage that translates to my brother against my brother and both of us against our cousin. We should remember that Hamas is a Sunni group, but it's funded by the Shiites in Iran. So is Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And so we
so see, they can collaborate when they see some mutual benefit.
And so it's possible, it's conceivable that the Saudis and Iran could combine against Israel in the future.
Well, I'm mostly concerned about them combining against our interests. And we've certainly given the Saudis cause under the Biden administration to do that. The Iranians have their own long-running antipathy towards us, of course, as you know so well, Robert. But I'm struck by the fact that in addition to the obvious things going on here, which is the Chinese have an interest in seeing if they can supplant us in the Middle East as a power there, benefit greatly from improved sources of supply of energy, and, you know, try to dominate both of these two important nations. But if they also can bring them, you know, into further alignment against the United States, that's a strategic development that is particularly ominous, it would seem to me.
Oh, yeah, and it could very easily happen. I mean, of course, Saudi Arabia has been an ally of the United States for a long time. We don't see the kind of rhetoric coming from Saudi Arabia that we have seen for decades from Iran with death to America and all that. At the same time, the Biden administration has been so hostile, and the Saudis have made it clear that they return the hostility. They rebuffed his overtures when he went to them to try to get them to lower gas prices. They are very resentful about his calling them to account regarding the death of Jamal Khashoggi. And we should also remember that there's a lot of anti-Americanism under the surface in Saudi Arabia, that 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudi it wasn't an accident. It was because they have been indoctrinated into beliefs and assumptions that lead them to think that America is a great threat. So it would not be hard to tip Saudi Arabia over into the hostility to America camp.
Yeah. Well, and to your point, Robert, of course, those hijackers, at least some of them, were actually trained in Iran to perform the kinds of missions that that they did. So we're not making this up, folks. This is a distinct danger emanating from the underlying hostility of not all Muslims by any means, but certainly Sharia supremacist ones to those they consider to be, you know, dhimmis or at least enemies, notably Christians and Jews. And so this is so fraught on so many different levels. And then, Robert, on top of all of that, we've had the Biden administration also engaging, it turns out, in active subversion of a democratically elected government in the state of Israel. We're going to be doing, as we speak shortly, a program about the latest evidence of the efforts to harm Israel and undermine what is unquestionably our most important ally, at least in the region. And I just wonder, you know, what on earth is the purpose here, as you see it, from an American point of view?
Frank, the Israeli left has been fomenting massive protests against the new Netanyahu government over the question of judicial reform, which is urgently needed in Israel, actually, as the judiciary has power that it doesn't have in virtually any other republic in the world. And yet the Biden administration wants a leftist government in Israel. It wants an appeasing accommodationist government that will give concessions to the Palestinians and so on. Netanyahu's government is not that. And so the Biden administration has been actively funding these protesters to go and protest organizations to go up against the Netanyahu government. They clearly want it to fall and there to be new elections that they hope to swing to their favor.
Hold the thought, Robert. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more, and in particular, what this witch's brew represents for our interests here at home, not just in the Middle East. Talk about that and more with Robert Spencer, author of The Sumpter Gamut, right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the contents of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at Salem Media, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case, money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back. We're speaking with Robert Spencer, the director of a marvelous organization, jihadwatch.org. You can find all kinds of information, both about his particular area of specialization, the jihad, and what it represents to those of us who love freedom, among other things, but also what their allies on the radical left are doing. The red-green axis is the way we've come to describe this partnership, unlikely as it seems. And Robert, I wanted to explore that with you a little bit. We've set the predicate for it by talking a bit about what's going on in the Middle East that may well result in renewed efforts here as well as elsewhere around the world to promote jihadism. Of course, as you know so well, we've relinquished the country of Afghanistan under the Biden appalling surrender there to the Taliban, which has apparently opened the place up to all of the other jihadis. We've left them $85 billion worth of arms with which to wage jihad, among other things. What could possibly be going wrong here, I guess is the question I'm asking. And not just necessarily overseas, but possibly here in the United States as well.
Well, domestically, the scandal regarding Afghanistan is that the special immigrant visa holders are not the people we brought over. The special immigrant visas were issued to Afghans who helped the United States forces while we were in the country. But Alejandro Mayorkas, the Department of Homeland Security secretary, admitted last year that only 3% of the people we brought over from Afghanistan were SIV holders, which means almost all of the people we brought over from Afghanistan were not the people who helped us while we were there. Now, not only does this create a tremendous danger for the people we did help, because many of them are still in Afghanistan, the Taliban is tracking them and killing them now, and they have no help from the Biden administration. But meanwhile, we have these people over here, and there are untold numbers of them that could be criminals, could be terrorists, and are just biding their time.
Yeah, they are. But for how long remains to be seen. I was speaking with a member of Congress night before last, in which he opined that they're biding their time, because of a lack of commitment to waging jihad inside the United States, but rather just to permit still more of their team to get in. And if they start attacking us from within, that almost certainly will finally result in a shutdown of the border. But it's a stay of execution, not a commutation of sentence. And Robert, I think I've talked with you about this, but one of the things that's particularly worrying about that cohort that we legally transferred into the United States is not only that many of them seem to be Taliban, not only not people who helped us, but people who were on the other side, but they seem overwhelmingly to be unaccompanied military age men. In other words, the kind of people who would be very apt to wage the jihad. And they've now been disseminated all over the country, as have many of these immigrants coming across the southern border as well. So all of this is perilous in the extreme. And I guess I just wanted to take stock with you in the hope that maybe I was misperceiving that now that they're here, they've begun assimilating into our country and all will be well. But when you combine their backgrounds and their attachment to Sharia, which, as you know better than anybody, commands jihad, with the fact that they are here in numbers, they are of the relevant age, and there is every likelihood that the Muslim Brotherhood apparatus in this country is aiding and abetting them in preparing for that next violent stage. Am I missing something here, or do you think that might be right?
I think you're all too right, Frank. It's incredible what's happening and how little awareness there is of it. For example, just last week, there were 13 people from the Islamic Republic of Mauritania who were arrested in Tijuana, right below the southern border in California. And they were arrested because when immigration officials appeared where at the hotel where they were staying, they all ran from the officials. And so that was suspicious in itself. Then you have the fact
it's that called a tell.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. It's called a tell when they start bailing out.
They are all young military age males as well. And in all the available news reports I found about this, not a single one asked or depicted any American official asking, well, why exactly are 13 guys from Mauritania trying to sneak illegally into the United States? What might be their intentions? But you have to wonder, when you have an Islamic Republic, are these people jihadis? And yet nobody even seems to be asking that question.
You know, we had a very interesting conversation about this subject, broadly defined at least, with Todd Benzman yesterday. He's the author of a terrific new book, as you know, called Overrun. And one of the things that he mentioned is not only that there are large numbers of people coming now from Sharia adherent countries around the world, but there's even a Sharia themed sort of housing facility. I can't remember whether it's in Tijuana or it's somewhere in the area south of the border.
Yeah.
That is, you know, designed to presumably facilitate their migration into the United States. Again, what could possibly go wrong?
Yes, the consequences of all this willful blindness could be catastrophic. And there is no telling how many are already here. Because as is well known, there were 98 people on the terror watch list caught at the border in the last year, which is a significant increase from previous years. And yet, of course, nobody knows how many people on terror watch lists got through and are in the country now.
The getaways, as they say. And then there's all those people who are terrorists, but who aren't on the terrorist watch list yet to be determined to be, you know, hostile powers. Robert, it's not always cheering news when we talk with you, but it's always news that we need to know, that's for sure. Thank you for your time. Thanks for your great work. And thank you, among other things, for Who Lost Afghanistan, an important, relatively new book from you at the Center for Security Policy Press. Keep up the great work, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. Elaine Donnelly, one of my all-time favorite people, and as well as one of the great leaders in this battle space of supporting the armed forces of the United States, especially with her understanding of the importance of the culture of our military and how, well, fragile it is, especially when people, civilian life, who know nothing of it, take liberties that damage or perhaps destroy the culture as well as morale and unit cohesiveness and all that depend upon it. Elaine is, of course, the founder and president of a marvelous organization, the Center for Military Readiness. She has been hard at work on behalf of our servicemen and women for decades, including serving on a defense and White House commissions on various issues affecting the military's readiness and culture. And we're always delighted to have a chance to catch up with her, especially on this occasion. Delaine, welcome back to Securing America.
Hi, Frank. Good to see you.
Let's start by talking about the latest evidence that the military is still confronting serious problems with recruiting and maintaining an all-volunteer force as a result.
Yes. Last year, the Army had a very dismal recruiting year. The Air Force this year, they're openly saying that they don't think they're going to be able to meet their goals. A lot of the reserve numbers of recruits they were rated to get through last year, and now they're going to have a shortage this year. One little bit of good news, the Army has come out with a new ad, and they've revived the classic slogan, "Be All You Can Be," and they've repackaged it with images of American servicemen in war, going back to the Revolutionary War. It is really delightfully not PC as the one with the girl with two mothers who joins the Army. That was a classic failure and contributed to the recruiting problems with the Army. The new ad doesn't do that. It's pretty good. And it ends with a realistic vision of young people on a bus to be all they can be. They can find a way to screw it up if they, you know, go too far off the line. But I hope it works for the Army. In the meantime, Congress is stepping in because there is something subversive going on in the Department of Defense that, of course, will have an effect on recruiting if it's allowed to continue. And that is critical. I'm sorry.
Tell us about that.
That is critical race theory instruction in Department of Defense education activity schools, DODEA. It's a subset of DOD, 67,000 students, the largest school system in the world. It is thoroughly imbued with critical race theory instruction, unfortunately, because they have appointed a woman to be the head of diversity and inclusion, whose name is Kalissa Wing. She is way out there as far as the left wing of critical race theory, DEI, you name it, support for Black Lives Matter. I ordered three of the books that she has co-written. These are different authors with Kalissa Wing. Now, these booklets, which are being used in some DOD schools, according to Open the Books, these are an entry-level introduction to anti-American ideology, which is endemic in critical race theory. Now, if you teach young people in Department of Defense schools, their parents are in the military, and you teach them that the United States is a racist nation, it was founded in racism, that is totally anti-Black, if you teach kids this, and these kids are the ones most likely to consider military service when they grow up, what you do is you are really eroding that solid base that recruiters have always depended on. And you could even cause divisions within families. I mean, if kids are in school and Department of Defense school and they see their parents in military uniform and they say, "Mom, Dad, why are you putting your life at risk for a racist country?" And where did they learn that? From Kalissa Wing and books like this that she sponsored, that she co-authored, and she is a top official in the Department of Defense. Now, guess what? I have some good news. The Department of, or rather the U.S. Senate and the House are sponsoring legislation to take on critical race theory in the military. And I'm very pleased that Tom Cotton, Blackburn, Daines, Lankford, and on the House side, Dan Bishop, they're sponsoring something called the Combating Racist Training in the Military Act of 2023. This is good legislation, and we need to get behind it.
Elaine, let me just put a fine point on this, because it's kind of implicit in what you've said, but it doesn't get said directly often enough, in my judgment, and that is, this critical race theory is simply a manifestation of Marxism, and it is all about taking down our country from within, whether it's on the civilian side, exactly the same sorts of factors at work here, cultivating, you know, divisions and enmity between people of different races, and fracturing families as well, but especially in the military. Doing this to the kids in our defense schools is unconscionable.
It is.
But it is part and parcel of a Marxist strategy for taking us down. And the fact that it has been bought as, you know, desiderata from the senior most people in the military. The personnel within the armed forces themselves, as well as their civilian, you know, sort of superiors, is just outrageous. So I really welcome this news about some pushback now coming from the Congress. I think all of those you've mentioned are Republicans.
Yes.
Is there any evidence that the Democrats are going to be supportive of this kind of
I certainly intend to find out. When you read these books, again, they're aimed at children. So they are entry level, but they have reflections of the Marxist ideology of Black Lives Matter. One of the books is specifically about Black Lives Matter, and it misrepresents and leaves out the whole truth about Black Lives Matter. This one, What is White Privilege and What is Anti-Racism? What you see here is a misstatement of history. Our children do need to know everything about history. Of course, slavery was a horrible experience. It was a culture at the time that existed all over the world. And the United States,
because still does,
of the Civil War,
to be clear,
still does. But the United States fought a bitter civil war, deadly civil war, to end it. And yet this book, the one about racism, it talks about Europeans and the British used Aristotle's teachings as one way to justify taking over countries that were not Christians. This was called colonization. Then it goes on to disparage Christian people. It says that the Christian people took over the Native Americans in the United States, and they imposed their view, and they too were not Christian. They were considered inferior. Colonists killed and mistreated them to get the land we now call the United States. It disparages our Constitution. It misleads people about what Black Lives Matter is all about. It tells them that do not think in colorblind terms. It takes that on. And it's so insidious because it's very subtle. There's a discussion of the Nazis in Germany and the Holocaust. And get this, it doesn't even mention the Jews who were killed in Holocaust. It doesn't even mention that. It's the half-truths or the untruths that are so corrosive.
Right. And obviously manipulating, of course,
yes,
as well. Elaine, I woke up to a news report. Let me just switch gears with you to talk about one of the other things you've focused carefully on over the years. I don't remember the exact anniversary, but I gather that it is an anniversary of when women were first allowed to serve in frontline combat roles. Mm-hmm. Give us your assessment. I think maybe it's a decade since that went into effect. Let's just pick a number. But how's it working out in the military?
It's not working out perfectly, far from it. One problem that is very obvious, and people talk about it when new reports from the Pentagon come out, the issues of sexual assault have not been mitigated. Those numbers keep going up and up and up. And it's wrong in any setting.
Including in the service academies, I'm told.
At the service academies, that report just came out. I expect the next one about, there's an office called Sexual Assault Prevention Response Office. They provide in excruciating detail all sort of data. And it keeps going up.
Attacks on men and women, as I understand
it,
as well.
Yes, on men and women. In terms of how women are competing with men in the physical area, Army's combat fitness test still remains a point of contention. They promised gender neutral or the same standards for men and women. It's not working in the combat arms. The Congress has intervened. They're going to continue.
It's not working, meaning that they're not able to get
women are getting injured at greater rates. Injured at greater rates. They're falling out, or they're not deployable. And so this experiment is not going well. One thing we do know is no one questions the courage of our women who serve. That has always been the case. It always will be. Women are a valuable part of our military, but the combat arms are the units that attack the enemy. And in those units, the differences between men and women really do matter. And the differences are causing problems. And the Secretary of the Army, Christine Warmoth, she doesn't want to acknowledge these problems. So it's going to be interesting to see. Senator Tom Cotton has pledged that he's going to be on the case of the Army to make sure that the combat arms, the infantry, the armor, artillery, that those units have standards that are commensurate to the job, not to meet diversity quotas, diversity, gender diversity quotas, metrics, whatever you call it, it lowers the standards over time because you have to make everything doable by women, even though men can do much more.
And Elaine, you know, as you said, this experiment isn't working out. Unfortunately, the proof of it not working out will be in combat. And God help us and our forces if it turns out that in that crucible, that real test, real world test, it doesn't work out to disastrous effects, as in our defeat.
Right.
Elaine, your work, your admonitions, your clarity on all of these topics over so many years is incalculably important, as I said earlier, and so appreciate it. We look forward to talking with you further
appreciate
about
your
all
work
of it.
Too, Frank.
Thanks for the good news. A little bit of it, at least.
A little bit.
Next up, Robert Spencer.
To do.
Got some jihad going on here, as among other places. Stay tuned for more right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, two Russian fighter aircraft intercepted and destroyed an expensive unmanned American aircraft in international airspace over the Black Sea. This was not, as the Pentagon would have us believe, an incident caused by Kremlin pilots' recklessness or unprofessionalism. Rather, it was a deliberate act designed to discourage the U.S. military from conducting legal and valuable intelligence collection against hostile powers with unarmed assets. It was also an ominous leading indicator of the erosion of our deterrence to acts of aggression. Russia isn't the first to thus demonstrate that America no longer operates from a position of assuring peace through strength. After all, the senior member of Vladimir Putin's No Limits partnership, the Chinese Communist Party, has been endangering even manned U.S. aircraft in the Pacific. Team Biden's feckless responses to date invite further testing of our perceived weakness and worse. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk about a variety of things we need to be concerned about in the protecting our country battle space, and who better to do that with than our friend and colleague, senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, very important member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and a patriot, both in uniform and as a civil servant in the United States government for many years, now the author of a terrific book entitled The Nation Will Follow. His name is Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired, and it's a delight to have you back, sir. Welcome once again.
Oh, thank you, Frank. Always an honor to be on your show.
Thank you. Well, let me start by asking you about this news from yesterday, John, concerning the takedown of an expensive piece of unmanned aerial vehicle, as they call it, in the international airspace over the Black Sea by not one but two Russian fighters. What did you make of it? What should we take away from it? And what do you think might be coming next?
Yeah, Frank. I mean, from what I've seen so far, these were Sukhoi Su-27 fast jets. I think this was an intentional downing. They did it by bumping, or getting their wingtip under the wingtip of the Reaper, flipping it fast, which would send the Reaper likely into an unrecoverable spin. So if they used guns or missiles, it would be too obvious. And, this way they could just say, oh, we bumped into it. Or they're probably saying, the Predator, the Reaper bumped into us. And, so this is gamesmanship. This is, you remember during the Cold War days, the confrontations that would take place at sea and in the air. This is the same thing all over again.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, John, whether the fact that it's happening with the Russians now It's been happening with the Chinese as well. They haven't lately downed one of our aircraft. They did it back in 2001, as I recall. But they're certainly putting aircraft, including manned aircraft, at risk. Do you think it's overstating the case to suggest that this may be a leading indicator of a degree of, well, diminished deterrence on our part, a sense that the old peace through strength of Ronald Reagan's day no longer operates?
Yeah, this is a return to the Jimmy Carter days of us having casualties inflicted upon ourselves and, you know, aggressive finger waving and lecturing. Carter was the original virtue signaler. And same thing again, you know, one of our aircraft gets shot down, a pilot captured. This happened all the time during the Carter days. And don't you do that again. You know, that just a total lack of understanding of the art of nation state tradecraft and asserting an American skill. So I don't want to go back to the days of American pilots getting shot down and captured and us agonizing over their imprisonment. No. I mean, we should defend ourselves in these situations. Oh, by the way, the Reaper can be armed with air-to-air missiles. Why don't we give them a nice surprise next time? But again, we shouldn't be this is getting us distracted. This is getting us ground down in the mire and muck of Ukraine when we should be putting 95% of our energy into preparing the Pacific to deter a Chinese move.
I wanted to ask you about that, as a matter of fact, John. One of the things that I think we both have been concerned about with our particular passion for the present danger from China specifically, is the need to be building up the defenses of Taiwan. And there was a report out of the Pentagon the other day that one of their undersecretaries of defense, I think for the acquisition side of the house, professed not to be terribly concerned about the defense industrial base meeting our present needs, because a lot of our kit has been migrated to Ukraine, as you know, but that we just may not be able to supply the kind of defensive equipment that we'd like to Taiwan as a result. A, does that sound right to you? And B, what are the implications of that? Again, if the Chinese are now increasingly persuaded that, we're not quite up to the job of deterring as in the past.
This would be shameful if there is any looting of what has already been bought and paid for by Taiwan, especially the reactivated Abrams tank assembly line in Lima, Ohio. This is for Taiwan. Taiwan is on the front line of freedom for us, for America. And the last thing we should do is be looting anything that is bought and paid for. And also, it's all also law now. The National Defense Authorization Act and the matching appropriation was chock full of Taiwan support over and over and over again, creating a lend-lease. So let's not go against U.S. law and start pilfering any of the assembly lines. We need to just, this is the problem with America and Biden America, you know, people working to make things and make things that make things on assembly lines are just, you know, that's beneath them. And that's backward thinking. No, this is foundational to the an economy of a great nation. We can't have everybody writing policy papers for nonprofits in D.C.
Yeah, well, and working at Starbucks and providing other services, needless to say. And John, you have done really seminal work for quite some time, notably with our Committee on the Present Danger of China. And everybody can find John's handiwork there and a lot of other content, by the way, including some 70 webinars, to which John has contributed mightily in many cases, at presentdangerchina.org, and I strongly commend that to you. But you have been among those who have been most, I think, explicit about the kinds of capabilities that we need to be making sure the Taiwanese have. Again, in the hope that we can deter the Chinese from attacking there or elsewhere for that matter. Can you just give us a quick appreciation of what you think that requires and whether we're providing it at the moment or not?
Well, as you know, Frank, and with your and Brian Kennedy's leadership, we've produced a number of policy papers going back a year and a half, 2 years on actionable actions to defend Taiwan. One of them is placement of American advanced force operators, essentially, and it does, the Biden team did mention, and we've shared these, we actually shared these policy papers with the White House to stir them into action. There is an American, they've said, I think it's a battalion size. We recommended a brigade, which is larger. It's like three battalions. But now we're now coming out and coming out of the closet and saying we do have ground forces on Taiwan. So we do have that trigger in place, but we need to flow 155 millimeter ammunition for the howitzers. We need to flow Javelin, we need to flow the anti-tank missile, we need to flow Stinger, the anti-aircraft missile, Patriot anti-aircraft and anti-missile, THAAD anti-missile, actually torpedoes too, and especially lots and lots and lots and lots of mines. We need to really mine all the approaches to make it very, very costly. And we need to give Taiwan all the help they need through foreign military sales. They've requested, and it's been slow rolled for years, advanced guidance and targeting capability on their missiles.
John, hold the thought. We'll be right back with more with Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired, right after this. Welcome back. We are visiting with the author of The Nation Will Follow, a terrific new book by Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired, former special operator in the United States Army, as well as a senior defense official on the civilian side of the Pentagon during his distinguished career post-military service. John, you have been talking with me a bit about Taiwan and what it takes to protect it. We are, you know, a lot of the things that were on that list that you've mentioned, from howitzer shells to javelins and stingers, are things that we have been sending in large numbers to Ukraine. In the process, I think there's no question about it, we've been depleting our own stocks, including pre-deployed stocks in Korea, as I understand it, also in Israel. To what extent can we continue to indulge in that, whether our industrial base is capable of providing replenishments or not? Is this a moment when really we need to be stopping the provision of that kind of equipment to Ukraine? And what would the consequences of that be, do you think?
Yeah, we first and foremost need to spin up the industrial base to greater levels of production. And hey, Austin, the Secretary of Defense, and team have had a year to admire the problem. We need to move aggressively. We need to move aggressively toward ramping up our defense industrial base. This shows the inability of the Biden team to just get their heads around the problem and direct action. So there's that. We need to minimize our stock, what we're saying to Ukraine. Right now, a lot of people don't understand it. There is the Russian side is in chaos, and the Wagner Group, which has been the primary crunchies pushing the infantry out onto the front line, with massive losses. They are in a huge struggle on the Russian side between the Ministry of Defense and the Wagner Group and the Putin leadership. They are in a mini civil war right now. And so that does not bode well for them. But we need to really minimize what we're sending. We need an inspector general. And I know Zelensky has made several strong statements about anti-corruption. Good. But we need more. We need an American inspector general to make sure everything is being accounted for and used in the proper, what it was intended for, and not sold. So we need to minimize the Ukraine distraction at this point in time.
John, a particular question that I wanted to put to you is, do you have a view on the advisability of providing F-16 aircraft to Ukraine?
That again becomes a distraction. I would prefer, I hesitate at that. I don't want American F-16s, because what this does is this consumes the staff oxygen available to think about the Pacific. So if a NATO partner wants to give some of their F-16s, fine, let them do that. But with us, you say, oh, it's only a few. It's just like the 31 Abrams tanks. It consumes enormous staff, the available staff cycles to work these issues, which should be focused 95% on the Pacific. So I'm not a big fan of U.S. F-16s. If a NATO partner wants to do it, fine, let them do that.
Presumably, that would be contingent upon us backfilling what they give up. But more broadly, John, as I think we've talked about in connection with the tanks, there is a concern that you would involve American contractor personnel, if not actual military personnel on the ground, to support these complex weapon systems. Is that a further concern? And would that arise even if it's a foreign nation's assets that are being sent there rather than our own?
Yeah, this is where the Kellogg, Brown, and Root monster rises out of the swamp and becomes a ginormous contractual vehicle that, again, just sucks up all the dollars, all the planning cycles, all the staff hours. That's the problem. This implies and specifies American logisticians, American trainers, American this, American that. No, no, no. Pacific, Pacific, Pacific.
But John, beyond just the staff time and the logistical tail as a further burden, are you concerned that, especially with this episode with the Russians, that that would almost certainly wind up bringing American military forces into conflict with Russians on the ground in Ukraine as well? Or is that not so much a concern?
Yeah, I mean, it further entangles us in the endless war in the Ukraine. You know, we had a senator, I'm not going to mention their name, that said, hey, we need to start shooting down their aircraft. No, absolutely not. Hey, you know, if we want our Reapers not be touched, put Stingers and Sidewinders under those, and they can use the Reaper to shoot down, give the Russians a surprise. Come on, we all know that. It's well known. We can equip them with that. And the Russians know we aren't, so they're just going to come up and bump into them and send them into a spin. So let the Reapers defend themselves. No, we should not actively be going out there trying to shoot down Russian aircraft.
And John, as you're looking at Taiwan, just to come back to that, and I know when we've talked about this previously, you, like other experts of our Committee on the Present Danger of China, have been very alive to the danger that should the Chinese go for it in the Pacific, that they will not confine themselves just to trying to seize one way or the other Taiwan, but that they will be going after allies of ours in the region for sure, especially ones that we have bases on their territory, but also against American assets, personnel, and possibly territory as well, Guam being a prime example. Is that your current reading of the danger that we're facing? And does it argue urgently for enhancing deterrence across a much broader scale than just trying to make sure that Taiwan is a porcupine, as it's been called, an unattractive target for the Chinese aggression.
Yeah, absolutely. When Taiwan West moves on Taiwan, they will rain fire on Guam and Hawaii. Mark my words. And there were some experts who called me up and just felt that that was over the top. And I said that, no, that makes absolutely—Hawaii and Guam is where America is going to project force to defend and defeat the Taiwan West. And so,
and why are you calling it Taiwan West, John?
Oh, that's in several of my briefings here. I've been referring to the mainland as Taiwan West, so not to inflame passions. And it'll tie down 50 MSS analysts anyway to try to figure out what that means.
What is it? Well, it's confusing me a little bit. So yeah. I'm in that company, I guess. Go ahead.
So, yeah, I had experts who really took exception, but I said it's intuitive that they're going to have to suppress by fire. That means the DF-26 long-range missile is going to rain down on Guam, Tinian, Saipan, and Hawaii. And I have a lot of relatives on Hawaii. And it's going to take a lot of hits, so get ready. It is real. And again, going nuclear, it could possibly go nuclear fast, and American continental U.S. territory could be at risk.
We could see it, I guess, both expand beyond that and escalate to incalculably dangerous levels. All the more reason, folks, why we have to be deadly serious about deterring the Chinese aggression. And that means adjustments in how we're doing business at the moment elsewhere around the world, for sure. John Mills, thank you so much. We have to let you go. Your support, your efforts, your work, particularly at the Center for Security Policy as one of our senior fellows and at the Committee on the Present Danger China, as one of its members, is deeply appreciated. I know you'll keep it up. And congratulations once again on The Nation Will Follow. God bless you, my friend. Next up, we're going to speak to Elaine Donnelly about falling recruitment statistics for the military of the United States at a very dangerous time. We'll be right back with more right after this.